This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have an update on the case of the so-called Irvine 11.
The 11 were protesting a speech by the Israeli ambassador in California. Normally, at worst, such protesters would be escorted out of the room. In this case, the normal wasn't the normal because they were pro-Palestinian. They were slapped with heavy misdemeanor charges.
We'll talk with Joe Allen, author of the book People Wasn't Made to Burn, a heartbreaking and intimate account of a Mississippi black sharecropping family, the Hickmans, beset with unimaginable hardship and tragedy after moving to Chicago in 1947. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, here we are in New York, and to get to the radio station, we actually walk near or past Wall Street, where there has been a Wall Street occupation for a number of weeks right now, and also some police way overreaction, violence, in fact, and assaults. So I know you at the National Lawyers Guild have been getting lawyers for everybody, representing people, et cetera. Give us a description of what's going on from a legal point of view.
The protesters are gathering in a spot called Zuccotti Park, which is actually privately owned, but the owners have said that the protesters can be there.
Isn't that amazing? How come?
I don't know. Maybe it makes them look good to be tolerant of this. But
so the cops can't go in the park?
The cops are lining the sides of the park, and there are a lot of undercovers. I got a few photos of some on Saturday.
Our brave Heidi.
Yes, and then they came over and photographed me 3 feet from my face, but I wanted to say, though, that on Saturday I was walking through Union Square and I saw dozens and dozens of police cars lining on the east side of the park.
Now, let me tell our listeners, Union Square is at 14th Street and Broadway going north, and it's about, 30 or so blocks or more from Wall Street and the sit-in.
Exactly. So I called someone at the National Lawyers Guild New York City chapter, and she said, run over to University Place and 13th Street. They're doing mass arrests.
University Place is right near Union Square.
Exactly. So I went over, and sure enough, the police had barricaded off the streets, and they had lined young protesters who had obviously just been arrested up against a wall, and they were starting to put them in vans and also a bus, a New York City bus that said out of service was being used to take them downtown.
That sounds like a typical New York City bus, out of service.
Exactly. But what had happened, which is noteworthy and which is a pin in the news all around the country, is that the police brought out their portable orange mesh that they used at the 2004 Republican National Convention to literally surround throngs of protesters standing lawfully on the sidewalk.
And let's take people back to that for a second.
Yes.
Again, you were there as well. Now, they arrested with that mesh in 2004. They surrounded 400 people. People pushing baby carriages, everybody in the neighborhood, and many of those people wound up at what we now not affectionately refer to as Guantanamo in the Hudson, a bus warehouse, oil all over the place, where they were denied their fundamental right to go to court and get out. It took days on habeas. This is not something new that's happened to the Wall Street occupiers. But in any case, you're up here now, this last week, watching this orange mesh be brought out.
Right. And then I went down, I watched them get on the buses, and we were able to determine that they brought them downtown to One Police Plaza, as well as 100 Center Street, where people are usually arraigned. They're held for a while, they're arraigned, and hopefully let go. So what I learned when I got to Zuccotti Park, and which everyone saw in the news, was that a white-shirted police officer had taken pepper spray and gone up very close in the face to several women who were behind the orange netting, not doing anything. They were just standing there, and he sprayed them in the eyes with pepper spray.
Now, it looks to me that video is all over YouTube, and there's even some that have little white arrows showing, here, watch this white-shirted cop's hands as he takes the pepper spray out and sprays it right on a peaceful woman standing there, a couple of them. And what's it looks to me, I mean, there's no way to understand this except utter vindictiveness, and there was no reason for this. This wasn't like an assault. This wasn't like these people were trying to do anything. They were standing there, and this white-shirted cop, a very high-level cop, goes over and puts this pepper spray right in the woman's face. And you have to watch the video to see it. And what was interesting in the article, and I want your comment on it, is this guy was also accused in prior demonstrations of using violence when it was not necessary.
And this was a deputy inspector. I cannot believe that the superiors would have authorized that, knowing as they do that the lawsuits are still continuing in the aftermath of even the 2004 RNC. There's vindictiveness, there's infliction of pain. It seems just mean-spirited to me, but it really sends a dangerous precedent unless this is addressed. And I think that the New York City considers it business as usual and is defending the officers,
well,
which is outrageous.
The first words out of the police commissioner is that there was nothing inappropriate. It was an appropriate use of pepper spray. I mean, pretty incredible. I mean, really incredible. I mean, this brings me, apart from the cops, which we've been after since you were born, Kaidi, since you've been on the front lines on this forever, this demonstration is very, very important. I mean, it started small, but even in the face of incredible police brutality, it is continuing, and people are still occupying Wall Street. And it's being looked now across the country as maybe, I mean, hopefully, the beginning of a wider movement of the dispossessed in this United States of ours.
I think this is one of the most exciting actions that we've seen for the reasons you just mentioned. And I can say that as we're taping a few days before we air, I went to the National Lawyers Guild, our office, before I came here. We were inundated with emails from people asking for Know Your Rights booklets, and also emails telling of other actions that are springing up in different states all around the country. I think this is an incredibly exciting movement that is gathering momentum.
So the two little ads we need to push for what people can do. One is, how do you get your Know Your Rights booklets, Heidi?
Well, you can call the National Lawyers Guild. We're on the web at nlg.org, or you can call 212-679-5100. We'll send you out our booklets. They're also on our website. You can download them.
Good. And the Center for Constitutional Rights also has a booklet called If an Agent Knocks, which has less to do with what Heidi's saying, which what happens at demonstrations, and more to do when the FBI goes after you. Both are important. The National Lawyers Guild one, particularly important. And there's also the book that the center has done that I've done called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, with contributions by our wonderful Heidi, who helped us. And that book tells you and really lays out what's happened in the past at these demonstrations and what is continuing to happen and how you have a right to protest in this country, in the streets, without being pepper sprayed, as well as the book from the center.
Exactly.
If an Agent Knocks.
Right. And you know why that's especially important, Michael? Because at this demonstration, and I went on a walk from Zuccotti Park down around Wall Street the other night, there were so many police officers literally running after protesters with video cameras. And I got a few shots of them standing up on a monument at Wall Street. And really, they're trying to get as many photographs to be able to identify protesters. And I hate to say it, because they fall, in their jargon, under the terrorist rubric. So they're collecting data as they're out there.
And Heidi, thank you again. Heidi's always on the front lines of all of these. So there you are, running the Guild's program for getting everybody represented.
With our New York City chapter, who's doing a splendid
job.
So
it's terrific. I've gotten a number of requests. Michael, where are the lawyers? And then, of course, the Guild has been doing it. So,
Michael, I don't think we can add too much to the commentary about the murder of Troy Davis at the hands of the state.
What was remarkable to me about it was essentially a public execution. They've gotten rid of hanging people in the public square, but in some way, this was the equivalent, because we saw hour by hour, minute by minute, the execution process beginning and ending. And I think one of the appalling things, it wasn't just the Troy Davis case, as important as it is and symbolic as it is about death penalties all over the country, is that it was essentially a public execution in the public square. And when I saw it, I mean, even, you just were appalled by it. You couldn't believe it. I was actually out of town And I called Karen, my wife, who works at Democracy Now!, and she said, Amy is right now in front of the prison, and it's 7 o'clock, and they just gave a reprieve, the Supreme Court. And so at that point, we're really hopeful. But who should know at 7 o'clock that it was a three-hour reprieve, and 3 or 4 hours later, he was dead. So this was a public, inch-by-inch, drop-by-drop public execution, and that's what we had in this country.
You see the exoneree getting a reprieve, and you're waiting. But this was unfolding in real life, and I know that so many of us at the Guild and at the Center for Constitutional Rights were really in a state of sort of suspended shock, just that this could be happening in this day and age with the number of people recanting and also with the community around the world watching our judicial system.
No, it's remarkable. And the effect, it was interesting because there are people executed all the time in this country. In fact, as we speak today, there's supposed to be someone executed tonight in Florida. But the Troy Davis case, because it got such prominence, because it had so many people behind it, because it was around the world, and because it was an unfolding minute-by-minute execution, just felt terrible.
Listeners should know that we've actually done several segments over the past few years on Troy Davis, and we've made three of them available on our website on the home page. The first one is in July 2007, where we talk about the witnesses who recanted and we interview Troy Davis's sister. So please go to lawanddisorder.org and you can hear the development of his case over the years.
It's quite moving because that first interview in 2007, look at that's almost 4 years. That's over 4 years ago. I mean, already we had recantations. We were already in a struggle. We were into those courts. And yet, 4 years later, despite all of that, the Supreme Court let this man be executed, the Supreme Court of Georgia and then the Supreme Court of the United States, despite the fact that there was a serious, I think probably no question, of this man's innocence.
There's just one word for it, Michael. Shameful.
Murder.
Michael, there was a lot of hoopla about the Palestinian Authority applying for statehood before the United Nations last week.
There was, Heidi, and it's quite important, but it probably won't go very far. Everybody from Hillary Clinton to President Obama to the New York Times came out and trashed the Palestinians for having the nerve after only 53 years to finally say, we've had it. The peace process is nothing but a process by which the Israelis take and gobble up more and more of our West Bank, more and more of East Jerusalem, and more of what was once the Palestinian territory. So it's an important event because it just shows that even the president of the PA, Abbas, is fed up with the United States and with the so-called peace process. And he was the guy that they supposedly had more or less in their pocket in a certain way between money and everything else. What's particularly interesting is here's all these claims, the United States, we have to restart the peace process and all this. In the face of it, what does Israel do again, indicating what's really going on here? A couple of days after the announcement of the Palestinians seeking statehood at the UN, the Israelis announced they want to build another 1,100 housing units in East Jerusalem, just south of the center of the city. This is clear Palestinian territory. It was territory that was conquered by the Israelis after 1967. It's occupied territory. It's utterly illegal for them to even step foot in there, much less be building these houses. And so this is the claimed partner that the U.S. is pushing to negotiate with the Palestinians. There's only one thing going on here. The Israelis love the, quote, peace process. They love all of that because during it, gobble, gobble, gobble. We're coming upon Thanksgiving, but this is gobble, gobble, gobble up as much Palestinian land as they can.
But announcing that, Michael, at this time is such an affront to even the artifice of engaging in a
process. Because that's what it is. It's an artifice at best, and I agree, it's an artifice at best, but this shows that it's not even an artifice. That the Israelis want one thing. To them, Jerusalem is an undivided capital of Israel. There's no such thing really as East Jerusalem, according to the Israelis. And when you read what's incredible, I was reading the coverage of this in the New York Times, which of course has these very, very pro-Israelis writing, pro-Israeli U.S. people writing for it, one named Bonner in particular. He writes, when he writes about the West Bank, he said there's 330,000 settlers in the West Bank. So I looked at that, and I looked at another article where they said, well, there's 330,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, the occupied territories. I said, that's not the number. Go on Wikipedia. The number's like 530,000.
Right.
So what does he leave out? He leaves out the 200,000 Israeli settlers who now live in East Jerusalem. It's 530,000, so the Times is implicitly endorsing the fact that East Jerusalem is essentially part of Israel, completely contrary to law.
Yeah.
And of course, the U.S. role in here, it's just so dirty and rotten, I mean, that it's not to be discussed. I mean, that they vetoed originally, there was a proposal to condemn the Israeli settlements as illegal. Obama had his puppets or something in the Security Council veto that resolution. And of course, they're going to veto any attempt by Palestine to declare itself a state. So this country is lined up firmly on the side of colonialism, exploitation, conquest by war, apartheid, etc., whatever terms you want to use around what Israel is doing.
Michael, we're coming up on an important 75th anniversary.
It's the 75th anniversary in October of the first international brigades to go to Spain who are going to fight on the side of the Republicans in Spain. It's quite important. There'll be events all over New York and all over the country and all over the world, because if people who may not be familiar with what happened in the Spanish Civil War, 1936, there was a Republican-Democratic government, and then there was an attempted a coup, actually, by the military and the generals. They couldn't get their control over the whole country, and out of that ensued the Spanish Civil War and eventually, of course, Franco. But even worse, what ensued was really the beginning of the fight against fascism, where the United States and the Western powers, more anxious to see fascism destroy communism than to stop fascism, did not side with the right side. And so what you had is the international brigades from the United States, from all over the world, heading into Spain to be on the side of the Republicans in Spain. Sadly, by 1939, the war was over, but we're now celebrating, really, the 75th anniversary of the international solidarity that, had it succeeded, we would have probably not had Hitler in Europe, the destruction of European Jewry and of millions and millions of others. Mm. So it's a very, very significant event. I get a magazine, and people should go for information to the Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade website. It's ALBA, ALBA-VALB.org. Just look up Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And they have a wonderful magazine called The Volunteer. But there's one thing I didn't know. I didn't realize that, you know, the next coming year, the poet laureate of the United States is a man named Philip Levine. Mm. Heidi, do you know anything about Philip Levine?
I've heard of Philip Levine.
That's all? Not more than that?
Can't recite any of his poetry.
But apparently Philip Levine is famous for working class subjects in his poetry. So it's quite an important appointment, and he's an older man who was born during the Spanish Civil War, but he also writes a lot of poetry about the Spanish Civil War. And I don't have one in front of me to read, but they asked him at one of his lectures, why is he so concerned about the Spanish Civil War? And he said when he was young, it began while he was a child, and the things he was hearing everywhere were true, that the Nazis and the Italians were there supporting the fascist army. And it was just more of the advance of fascism. This is Philip Levine talking. And so-called, I like the way he says that, this is the poet laureate of the United States, and so-called Western democracies were doing a pathetic job of combating it, fascism. They were looking the other way. And if you look into the history, you know that they wanted fascism to succeed. It was a way of eliminating communism. This man will next year be our poet laureate. So some good things happen occasionally. It's the 75th anniversary. We hope to bring you a full program on this within the next few weeks.
That's a lovely update. Thank you, Michael. Earlier this year, 11 Muslim students were arrested on charges of disrupting a speech given by the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren. The incident took place on the campus of the University of California at Irvine. The local district attorney claims that the students had no right to disrupt the event, charging them with conspiracy to shut down the ambassador's speech, even though he was able to complete that speech. Supporters claim that the Muslim students' actions are protected by the First Amendment and that they are being charged for being vocal critics of Israel. Last month, an Orange County court found 10 of the 11 Muslim students guilty of two misdemeanors. Facing up to 1 year in jail on multiple misdemeanor charges, they were sentenced to 3 years of probation and 56 hours of community service, as well as fines. Each was convicted of one misdemeanor count of conspiring to disrupt Oren's February 8th, 2010 speech and a second count for actual disrupting of the speech. To talk more about this decision, we're joined by defense attorney Lisa Holder and co-counselor Dan Stormer. Lisa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Many of us have followed with great interest the case of the so-called Irvine 11, and we were disappointed to hear of the verdict. Was it a surprise for you before we go into sort of the details of the case?
I will say that I was disappointed. As an attorney, a defense attorney, you sort of psych yourself up during the trial. I have overcome the challenges, and this jury is going to feel compelled to find my client not guilty. To the extent that that is just something that you psychologically do in every trial, yes, I was very surprised. But taking a step back, going into it, I knew that there were some very, very difficult challenges in this case. So realistically, it was not shocking.
Well, take us back and sort of pretend that Michael and I are the jury. How would you describe the actual event where the students allegedly disrupted the talk? What did they do?
The students modeled their protest after a protest that took place in Chicago, where students protested the speech of Israeli Prime Minister Olmed. It happened, and this was a protest in Chicago University a couple of years back. Anyway, and so what happened at UC Irvine is that the students stood up serially. So there were 10 students who stood up one after the other, probably with about 3 or 4 minutes in between each statement. And they made each student made a short statement of protest. And a statement that was very specific to some incident that involved Palestine-Israel relations or some incident that went to the bombing in Gaza. So they were very short and specific, pointed statements that were related to the speaker's work in Israel.
That's interesting. And what happened to those people in Chicago?
None of them were arrested.
Right.
I mean, it was, you know, Clearly, the administrators at the University of Chicago knew that there would be protests. It's something that happens frequently on college campuses, especially in the context of a political meeting involving a controversial political speaker, such as the Prime Minister of Israel, Olmert. They seem to have a very high tolerance level for the protests.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, I have a cousin of mine, Emily Ratner, who's in New Orleans. And he was also in New Orleans at some point, and they did a similar protest. There were five people in the audience, and they won serially at different moments, stood up and made the protest, and then that was it. Nothing happened to them. And so
Correct. So
the question is, any protest around Israel is always subject to, you know, more stringent law enforcement actions generally, although, as you said, there's much more tolerance, at least in some universities and places. How do you explain why the Irvine 11 were charged each with two serious misdemeanors?
I believe the explanation for that has very much to do with the content of the student's speech, the fact that they were pro-Palestinian. The evidence in the case, which we tried to bring out, but in many cases we were not permitted to bring out because of legal constraints placed on us by the court, a lot of the evidence showed that this group of students who have a pro-Palestinian perspective were targeted. It really seems to be related to Islamophobia and wanting to basically shut down pro-Palestinian perspectives.
And what were the arguments that the prosecutor made?
The prosecutor framed his whole case around this notion that the students shut down the First Amendment rights of the speaker.
Even though the speaker finished his talk?
Even though the speaker finished his talk, this is the way that they had framed it from the beginning. In the statements that they made to the press over the last year, they constantly talked about how students violated Speaker Orrin's rights. Now, in terms of their framing, it makes no sense from a legal perspective, and here's why. The way the Bill of Rights works is that it exists to protect individuals from the government. So in terms of the First Amendment, which protects free speech, the Fourth Amendment, which protects us from unreasonable searches and seizure, it protects the individual from the government impeding on those rights. An individual cannot impede or cannot violate another individual's First Amendment rights. Only the government can do that. So, I mean, that might sound like a technical argument, but from a First Amendment perspective, there's a critical distinction that needs to be made.
You know what? You're completely right about that. I mean, I understand it. It's only the government that can either suppress or is required to permit First Amendment activities. You could argue that there's other things people may get accused of, but violating First Amendment rights seems impossible.
Exactly, and that's the argument. That's the way that the prosecutor framed their argument from the beginning. And we challenged that argument from a legal perspective, from a First Amendment perspective, but the court allowed him to put that argument in front of the jury. Just to give an example, if an individual is assaulted by another individual, we don't bring a case and argue that the individual who assaulted the person violated that person's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable seizures. We only would bring that kind of case if it was a government entity, someone acting under color of law, like a police officer who assaulted another individual. So the way that the prosecutor framed it makes no sense legally. And they should not have been able to argue to the jury that these students violated Mr. Oren's free speech rights.
What was the composition of the jury?
There were 6 men and 6 women, I believe. It was a fairly multiracial group of jurors.
Now, were these all students at university?
They were students at University of California, Irvine, and students at UCR, University of California, Riverside.
Let me ask, because, you know, when the judge made a statement, which you have to quote better than I can, something about how they did this for what people thought was, you know, legitimate purpose or their beliefs, and therefore he wasn't going to give jail time, which was at least something. But he did give 3 years probation, which seems to me, I mean, just off the wall. I mean, I don't even have words for 3 years probation. So how do you explain what was going on in this judge's mind?
I think the judge, you know, after hearing our arguments and after witnessing these students over the course of a year coming to court, these are wonderful young men. They're very gracious people, and there's no way that the judge could lose sight of that. He recognized the sincerity of their beliefs and the sincerity of their statements, and he incorporated that into his sentencing, and that's why there was no jail time in this case. But the 3 years probation was out of line, and what the court has indicated is that once the week of community service is done, he will reduce that to 1 year probation.
Because probation essentially is taking them off the streets as activists. I mean, it means you basically, you know, you can't do anything while you're on probation, almost. I mean, it's a severe penalty. So at least reducing it to 1 year is something. Still seems, you know, crazy to me. But anyway.
And we should note, each student was convicted of one misdemeanor count of conspiring to disrupt the speech. Have you seen the charge of conspiracy used in this kind of First Amendment case before?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, the way that the DA's office framed this case and approached this case is just very novel and outrageous. Because really what was being prosecuted in that conspiracy charge was their First Amendment right to assemble.
That's
because
right.
what the prosecutor was saying is that these students got together beforehand as a group and organized. We have a right under the First Amendment to assemble and to organize. So again, in both charges strike directly at the heart of the First Amendment and our First Amendment rights.
Were there any consequences for the students at university?
Yes, there were consequences for the students at the university, but they all ended up graduating.
Great. What's next? The appeal? What's going to happen?
Yeah, we are planning on filing our notice of appeal within the next month, and then appealing this case until we get some recognition from some higher court. The California Penal Code section under which this case was brought violates the First Amendment. The Penal Code section 403, essentially says you can't disrupt a meeting, violates our First Amendment right to free speech. Also, it is extremely vague and overbroad, and so if you actually read that Penal Code section, you won't really understand what you can do as a protester, because it is just extremely vague. It also chills speech, and it needs to be taken off the books. We brought that argument to the trial court in our demurs. The trial court rejected them, so we have a record for those arguments, and we will appeal to the Court of Appeals, to the California Supreme Court, and to the Supreme Court of the United States if need be. This is an unconstitutional law. It violates our First Amendment rights, and it needs to be taken off the books.
Lisa, thank you so much. We're going to be continuing to watch this case if you make it up to the Supreme Court, and we know there will be a strong people's movement to support you.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being with us, Lisa.
Here to talk more about the Irvine 11 case is co-counsel Dan Stormer. Dan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure being here.
We've heard a lot about the case of the Irvine 11, and there's been wonderful support organizing around this case. Tell us basically why you think the case was brought in the first place.
My opinion is that it was brought for political reasons and for reasons that relate in some ways uniquely to our times and uniquely to Orange County. That is, there is, I think, throughout the nation, a real Islamophobia is really taking hold. And in Orange County, there's a significant Muslim population, and I think that there is just basically fear of that population. This was a good mechanism to tamp it down.
You mentioned Islamophobia, Dan, but of course it was a protest about Israeli policies against Palestinians. So do you think Islamophobia is really the main explanation, or is it just combined with the fact that it was a hot political issue?
That's a very good question, and one to which I don't know the answer. I tend to think not. I tend to think that that issue is simply not a hot enough issue and not a hot button enough issue in Orange County to generate the response that it did, the criminal response that it did. I don't deny that that might exist, but I tend to believe that it really is Islamophobia, sort of 9/11 hysteria, more Arab-Muslim focused than Israeli-Palestine focused.
That's actually very helpful. It's the first time I've really, you know, all my reading and thinking about it, it's the first time I've actually heard that articulated in that way, so thanks.
Dan, I was interested in the use of conspiracy.
The use of conspiracy in this case allowed them to get in all sorts of evidence that might not otherwise be admissible. Even though they pled only one co-conspirator at every avenue when they wanted to use an evidence section 1253 to get in statements of co-conspirators or information that could lead to proving a conspiracy, they were able to do it through the use of this conspiracy allegation.
Can you tell us a bit about the penal code section? Lisa was telling us that she felt it had a chilling effect on free speech, but we didn't go into details about it.
Well, Penal Code Section 403 is an incredibly broad-based statute with virtually no facial limitations that essentially says disrupting a public meeting is unlawful. There is a case, a 1970s case called In Re K, which puts some limitations on it. But the way the statute still reads and read in conjunction with this In Re K decision still essentially says if you upset a meeting and you substantially interfere with its progress, you can be criminally prosecuted. I think that the statute is unconstitutional, and that's going to be a primary basis for our appeal.
I know that I've been reading about the sentencing, and of course the judge said something about these people are not goodwill necessarily, but were sincere or something. And then despite that, he didn't give them a jail sentence, but he did give them what I consider to be a draconian 3-year probation, 3 years of probation. And that seems inexplicable to me, except that he wants to keep Muslims off the streets for the rest of their lives almost. But how do you explain that?
The 3-year probation is actually ultimately a 1-year probation. If they complete their 56 hours of community service within the next 6 months, I forget the specific date, if they complete it within that time frame, then it becomes a 1-year probation. It really is, in my estimation, something that this judge does and is interested in doing to assure that community service is completed in a timely fashion. I think he views it as a 1-year probation.
And do you consider that severe for this?
Remember, the district attorney was calling for jail time, and in fact, the district attorney attacked the judge subsequently or failing to give jail time. I think it is a severe sentence, but given Orange County and the nature of the hysteria against our clients, I'm ultimately very pleased with the sentence.
I wanted to ask you about DA Tony Rakakis. Is he new to this job?
No. He is a former judge who ran and was elected several years ago. He is a very, very conservative man whose political sights were significantly higher than being the DA of Orange County. He got aced out in the primaries and was sort of stuck with the concept that he was going to have to run again. And I personally think that this prosecution had, a significant amount of this prosecution had to do with giving his sort of criminal law bona fides against terrorism to assure that he got elected the next time around, because there were lots of allegations about his behavior that have been floating around Orange County, and his name arose in the criminal prosecution of the former sheriff.
In your experience, you've been a lawyer for a very long time, as have I, and for the conduct that was done here, which was standing up in a speech and saying something, and the guy's allowed to finish his speech. Have you, in your experience, ever had people charged with with misdemeanors like that?
No, it is absolutely despicable that they were charged with misdemeanors. The background, which Lisa may have discussed with you, is they actually took this to a grand jury and alleged that they might file a felony conspiracy and felony allegation against them. It is just shocking that this was prosecuted. I mean, we showed during the trial videos of other demonstrations in which there weren't even arrests, much less prosecutions. And some of those took place by UCI administrators being in the demonstration against Muslim speakers. It's just shocking and horrifying that this prosecution went forward.
Well, you're going to appeal.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sure you're going to have as strong, if not stronger, a movement behind you.
Well, this is a very interesting issue, is when the students protested, there was an issue in the Muslim community about whether they were acting appropriately, whether it was anti-Islamic to protest in a way that might be disrespectful. These kids took a lot of heat from their own community. As the case went on and as what they had did and what they were protesting became more apparent, the community just came out in support of them in a way that is really, really moving. Mm. So the end result of this prosecution, in my opinion, is a much more focused, much more determined community than went into the process.
That's really heartening to hear.
It's a wonderful result for the community in some ways.
Well, great, Dan, as usual.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Dan.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
People Wasn't Made to Burn is a heartbreaking and intimate account of a Mississippi black sharecropping family, the Hickmans, beset with unimaginable hardship and tragedy after moving to Chicago in 1947. Within a year, four of their infant children perished in a massive blaze in an overcrowded tenement. Sickened with grief, their father took justice in his own hands and shot the landlord, who admitted to setting the fire. James Hickman was convicted of murder. The story takes off as author Joe Allen gives the readers an inside look into the strategy to defend Hickman in the most racist area of the country. Author and journalist Joe Allen joins us today to talk more about the book.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Joe, the central figure in your really good book is a man named James Hickman. Sharecropper, came up from Mississippi to Chicago with his family. Tell us his story.
Well, I think his story is really symbolic of really of a whole generation of African Americans who left the South for the North or for the West to find a better life and a measure of dignity and freedom that they couldn't find in the old Jim Crow South. His story was typical of many black Mississippians. That is, he grew up essentially on a poor plantation, spent most of his life with his wife, Annie Hickman, working long, very long hours with a large family, earning little to no money for their labors on plantations in the central part of Mississippi and then in the Mississippi Delta. You know, like typical of a whole generation of people, at a certain point in time, he realized that there was just no future to any of that, not just for himself and his wife, but also for his youngest children. And he came to Chicago and permanently settled here in 1945. He got a job in the steel industry, which again was very typical of a whole generation of African-American men in particular who came to the Midwest. And he found that in that way his life, you know, overnight and dramatically improved, but also typical of many African-Americans who came to the North and the West, but particularly to Chicago, while you were sort of welcomed here for the hard work and labor that you would give, particularly to the big steel plants, finding a home was the thing that was a source of incredible frustration and humiliation.
In reading the book, I think the housing issue really comes out as crucial. Mm-hmm. And talk about that a little bit, because it really is the heart of the book and the heart of probably, you know, these kind of areas in many places in the country, but in Chicago in particular.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, housing really becomes the whole issue, whole thing that James Hickman's future trial is really revolves around. And you know, most people, when they think of the old Jim Crow era, they think of laws that segregate the races, and, you know, despite calling it separate but equal, it really is separate and unequal, and that's something that applies to the South or the border states. The fact is that when James Hickman and a whole generation of African Americans came to Chicago, there were perfectly legal laws that allowed homeowners not to sell their homes or rent their apartment buildings to African Americans.
Restrictive covenants.
Restrictive covenants, racial covenants, you know.
The number you had in the book was 80% of the housing in Chicago was, quote, protected from blacks by restrictive covenants. Incredible.
Yes, it's pretty incredible. And, of course, similar things existed in other cities. But, you know, with Chicago being the largest city in the Midwest then and now, of course, that had a huge impact on, you know, housing all over the country. And what this, you know, meant in essence is that the African-American population, really up until the Second World War, and it begins to change a little bit after that, was really confined to a very thin sliver of land on the south side of the city.
Yeah, but Joe, you know, tell us also, not only were they herded into this sliver of land, but tell us about what the conditions were in the few buildings where they were allowed to rent in.
Well, it's incredibly overcrowded because, you know, if you're segregated into a tiny area, what it really ends up being is that, you know, slumlords and real estate companies and the banks that back them, what they do is they obviously try to use this limited space to make as much money as possible. So what became typical housing or living conditions for African Americans was this cute sounding but pretty terrible housing called kitchenette apartments, which were in essence one-room hovels that in most cases didn't have running water or electricity, and very horribly, you know, rat-infested. Richard Wright's book, Native Son, the whole first opening is about what these living conditions were like. And because African-Americans literally couldn't move out of the ghetto for both legal reasons, like the racial covenants, but also because of the incredible racist violence that they would face, they ended up paying enormous amounts of money for these tiny little places. And as time went on, particularly during and after the Second World War, as more and more African Americans came to Chicago, you had more and more people crammed into even smaller apartments, paying even higher rents for what were really terrible and unsafe conditions. And one of the products of that was fires that really just killed an enormous amount of people.
You talk about a lot of this, but you do a beautiful job, really, of sort of pinning it on the story of James Hickman and his mm-hmm. family. Mm-hmm. Can you give us, continue a brief nutshell of what happened in his case?
One of the things I really benefited from in the book is that one of the great social true crime writers of the time, even though I don't think he would have called himself that, was a man named John Bartlow Martin, who ironically later became a U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic. He interviewed the Hickmans after the trial was over. James Hickman recounts in there, you know, very eloquently, but also when you read it, you're very exhausted about his kind of, you know, search for housing. So, you know, he would work the night shift or the graveyard shift, if you'd like to call it that, at Wisconsin Steel, get out of work at 7 or 8 in the morning, and then he would sort of literally trek all over the city, just trying to find a place for him and his very large family to live in. And it's exhausting reading. He goes from literally one end of the city to another just to try to find a place to live, and had the door slammed in his face each time. When he thought he finally found a place, it was being rented to him by a man named David Coleman, which is another element of tragedy to the story, because though black landlords were not as rare as I think people would probably assume that they were at that time, it still was not very common. And so when he met David Coleman, he promised him an apartment for his family on the west side of Chicago, which was really the beginnings of the black west side back in the 1940s. And, you know, Hickman put down a rent for his place, but Coleman said that the place that he was going to give him wasn't going to be available to the end of the month, and so he had to live in the attic. And though him and James Hickman and his wife Annie really reluctantly took this second option, hoping for a better place in a few weeks, it ended up the fact that Coleman just took advantage of him, took his money, and never gave him the apartment that he wanted. And when James Hickman raised this issue of what was going to happen next with the money that he gave him, David Coleman essentially threatened him with being burned out of the apartment. If you don't leave, I'll set fire to the place. And it was later found out through testimony at particularly the coroner's hearings after the death of James Hickman's children that David Coleman had threatened many residents of the building that they all lived in at 1733 West Washburn. Tragically, on the night of January 16th, 1947, when James Hickman went to work, he was so worried about the possibility of something happening, either a fire breaking out because of the terrible conditions in the building, or Coleman acting on his threats. He asked his two eldest sons to stay with his wife and four youngest children in this tiny little room. And soon after James Hickman went to work and after the kids went to bed, a fire indeed did break out that ultimately killed the four youngest children in the Hickman family.
The book is, of course, extraordinary in detailing that about the deaths of four of his very young children in that fire.
Right.
And then what unfolds is next a murder, apparently. Why don't you just talk about that and then what happened at the trial?
You know, what happens, of course, is that on January 16th, 1947, a fire breaks out. And, you know, as one of the police chiefs, fire chiefs at the time said, it was like a holocaust. That is, it had spread very quickly. It spread so quickly that Annie Hickman, the mother and wife, and one of the eldest sons, Willis Hickman, made it out the one window of their apartment, of their attic apartment, and essentially jumped to safety, even though they were injured very badly. Charles Hickman was able to jump through the flames in one of those sort of miraculous events that you look back and you wonder how someone was able to do it. But because of the speed of the fire and the incredible smoke, the four youngest kids, as children do in fires, they go under the bed or they go into closets, and they suffocated and burned to death in the fire. James Hickman was called at work and was told that he had trouble in his home. When he got there, he found out that his wife was and sons were in the hospital, but his four youngest kids were dead. And this really begins a kind of horrible journey through the lack of response by the police and the state's attorneys to his case. Most Americans today have no memory of how coroners used to play a much more prominent role in the criminal justice system. That is, that they used to actually hold public hearings, take sworn testimony, and make recommendations that, depending on the jurisdiction, were sometimes binding and sometimes not on the further actions of the police or the district attorney. And the coroner here in Chicago was a man named A.L. Brody, who was a loyal Democrat, nothing very distinctive about him. But he held four separate hearings into the death of the Hickman children, which is quite extraordinary because most cases only get one unless they merit some special attention. And the coroner's hearings really were very wide-ranging. And what they did is they explored not just simply the immediate cause of the death of the Hickman children, but also were a very wide-ranging expose of the general living conditions in the building, and particularly the testimony of other tenants who had been threatened by David Coleman.
At the end of the day, nothing was done.
Nothing was done. The coroner recommended that the state's attorney and the police further investigate the case, and they simply didn't do that. I remember sitting with Willis Hickman, the surviving son who still lives to this very day on the west side of Chicago, and I asked him very point blank, did anybody from the police or the state's attorney's office or any governing body or investigating body in the state of Illinois ever formally interview you about the death of your siblings, aside from the coroner? And Willis said no. 6 months after the death of the children, the mental health of James Hickman, the father, of course, had seriously deteriorated. I mean, grief and rage. 6 months to the day of the death of his children, he went over and confronted David Coleman at his home on the south side of Chicago. And while we'll never know exactly what happened that day, because we only know it from the testimony of James Hickman, he confronted David Coleman about not only the money that he had taken from him, but also accused him of killing his children. And when David Coleman refused to acknowledge any of that, he later said that Coleman confessed. He pulled out a gun, and he shot him and mortally wounded him. In sharp contrast to the death of his own children, of the Hickman children, the police acted very quickly in this case and arrested James Hickman, and the state's attorney charged him with murder. He faced the possibility of execution in the death in the electric chair at the time, or at a minimum 14 years in prison.
But as we know, that didn't happen.
And that didn't happen.
When he got out of jail, he never went to prison. The state was unable to put him in prison, all they wanted to. And that was a consequence of this magnificent defense committee that was formed in Chicago. I think the great lesson from your book is how you build the defense committee and expose these conditions and have a political trial. Tell us what the defense committee was able to do, who constituted it, who did they organize, how did they get James Hickman from having to go to prison?
You know, the way that I would look at it, Michael and Heidi, is that, you know, one of the things about, of course, politics and life being very different from it is today in the United States is that we had a very large socialist and communist and radical left at the time. And, of course, the biggest group on the left was the American Communist Party, very huge, had something like 100,000 members. But there were other competing organizations. A much smaller group was the Socialist Workers' Party of the United States. It probably had about 2,000 or 3,000 members at that point in time. Their Chicago organizer was a very dynamic man named Mike Bartel. And long before, you know, James Hickman came on the scene, the Socialist Workers' Party had been very active around civil rights issues in the city and around organizing tenants. And in fact, they first came into contact with James Hickman as a result of the fire at their home that killed his children. They went out and actually organized public meetings around unsafe housing on the west side. And one of the lawyers for the SWP, a man named Mike Meyer, who had sort of turned himself into an expert on tenant issues, represented James Hickman at one of the coroner's hearings. When the events that went down in July, when there was the final confrontation between James Hickman and David Coleman, Mike Bartel and Mike Meyer swiftly went into action to organize a defense campaign. And they went out of their way to sort of think about how you could organize something very, very big and very important and something that could really tap into not only the sort of experiences and outrage of the black community in Chicago, but also the real resources that radicals represented in the labor movement of the time. And so they pulled together very quickly a Hickman Defense Committee that had such people as Sidney Lenz, who became very famous in the 1960s as an anti-war activist and as a great historian, Willoughby Abner, who unfortunately has sort of been forgotten about in labor history, but was a very charismatic black trade unionist in Chicago and the future head of the NAACP here. He played a very prominent role in pulling together the committee. Leon Dupre, who became a very famous, independent-minded alderman in the 19, 60s and 70s, a real thorn in the side of Daley the First, joined the legal team with Mike Meyer to represent James Hickman. And they organized a very broad-based and very active campaign. They organized, you know, collections and petitioning and street meetings. And most famously, they got two people who, you know, again, have either been forgotten or their images are not well-known around these issues. The first was Willard Motley, who wrote a book called Knock on Any Door. He was a black novelist, and his book came out in 1947, became a best-selling book and later a movie. He wrote this very eloquent and very biting appeal for James Hickman that was published in virtually every major black newspaper in the country. And Tallulah Bankhead, who has now had something like six Broadway plays about her, who is sort of remembered as a kind of eccentric personality. But at the time, she was also known as a very strong critic of Jim Crow and for racial integration, despite coming from a very backward and very powerful Democratic Party family in Alabama. They organized a mass meeting of about 1,500 people on the south side of Chicago at the Metropolitan Community Church, which had been a center of trade union and civil rights organizing. And they created, really, a movement that pushed the Cook County State's Attorney, which is what we call the district attorney here, back on its heels. And they won the fact that on the eve of Hickman's trial, they announced that they weren't going to ask for the death penalty, which was really a major victory. And in the words of Leon Dupre, it took a certain edginess off the campaigning. But instead of cutting a deal with the state's attorney, which is what I think ultimately they wanted when they dropped the issue of the death penalty, they pressed forward and turned the trial really into a trial not only of David Coleman, but really of the racist housing conditions that existed in the city and the circumstances that not only led to James Hickman doing what he did, but also exposing the non-response from the police and the state's attorney's office. In many ways, the whole Hickman story and what happened wouldn't have happened, very simply, if one, James Hickman and his family could have lived anywhere that they wanted to, but they couldn't do that at the time because of these racial covenant laws. And the second is because the police and the state's attorney simply didn't respond to what was obviously an act of arson and murder that killed the four youngest kids of the Hickman family.
Joe Allen, the author of People Wasn't Made to Burn, a true story of race, murder, and justice in Chicago. Joe, you've done what radical historians should do, and that's to recover the usable past. We thank you for it, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Joe.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web.